Your presence in Crydee is not vital, at least not for now. Fannin and Godan are able men, and should the need arise, I think your sister would prove no mean commander. They should be able to keep things under control as well as you.
Martin said,
But you must ask yourself this. What will your father do when he learns Guy does not simply rule in Krondor as Erlend's aide, but holds the city completely in his power, that he's sending no aid to the far coast, and that he means to have the throne?
Arutha nodded vigorously.
You are right, Martin. You know father well. It will mean civil war.
There was sorrow on his face. He'll withdraw half the armies of the West and march down the coast to Krondor and not stop until Guy's head is on a pole before the city's gates.
Then the course will be set. He'll have to turn east and march against Roderick. He'd never wish the crown for himself. But once begun, he cannot stop short of total victory or defeat. But we'd lose the West to the Serrani in time. Bricall couldn't hold them long with only half an army.
Jimmy said, This civil war sounds a nasty sort of business. Arutha sat forward. Wiping his forehead, he looked up from under damp locks.
We've not had one in 250 years, since the first Boric slew his half-brother, John the Pretender. Compared to what this would be, with all the East marshalled against the West, that was only a skirmish.
Amos looked at Arutha with concern upon his face.
History's not my strong suit, but it seems to me you'd do best by your father keeping him in ignorance of this turn of events, until the Serrani spring offensive is finished.
Arutha exhaled a long, low breath.
There's nothing else for it. We know no aid will be forthcoming for Crydee. I can best decide what to do when I return. Perhaps in council with Fannin and the others we can work out some defence for when the Serrani come.
His tone was one of near resignation.
Father will learn of Guy's plotting in due time. This sort of news is too hard to keep. The best we can hope for is he'll not hear of it until after the Serrani offensive. Perhaps by then the situation will have changed.
It was obvious from his tone he didn't think that likely.
Martin said, It may be the Serrani will choose to march against Ilvander, or carry the battle to your father.
Who can say? Arutha leaned back and became aware of Anita's hand resting gently upon his arm.
What a choice we have, he said quietly. To face the possible loss of Crydee and the far coast of the Serrani, or to plunge the kingdom into civil war. Truly the gods must hate the kingdom.
Amos stood.
Trevor tells me he has a ship. We can sail in a few days. With luck, the straits will be clearing when we arrive.
Lost in the gloom of his own personal defeat, Arutha barely heard him. He had come to Krondor in such confidence. He would win Erlend's support for his cause, and Crydee would be rescued from the Serrani. Now he faced an even more desperate situation than had he stayed home. Everyone left him alone, save for Anita, who spent silent minutes just sitting at his side. Dark figures moved quietly toward the waterfront. Trevor Hull led a dozen men with Arutha and his companions down the silent street. They hugged the walls of the buildings, and every few yards Arutha would cast a backward glance to see how Anita fared. She returned his concern with brave smiles, faintly perceived in the pre-dawn darkness. Arutha knew that over 100 men moved down adjacent streets, sweeping the area of the City Watch and Radburn's agents. The mockers had turned out in force, so Arutha and the others could safely quit the city. Hull had carried word the night before that for a considerable cost, the upright man had arranged for one of the blockade ships to drift off-station. Since learning the true situation, including Guy's plan to become Prince of Krondor, the upright man had given over his not inconsiderable resources to aid the prince's and Anita's escape. Anita wondered if anyone outside the Guild of Thieves would ever learn the mysterious leader's true identity. From what chance remarks Arutha had overheard, it seemed only a few within the Mockers knew who he was. With Guy on his way back to the city, Jocko Radburn's men had increased their searching to a near-frenzied pitch. Curfew had been instituted, and homes randomly entered and searched in the middle of the night. Every known informant in the city, and many of the beggars and rumor-mongers as well, had been dragged off to the dungeons and questioned. But whatever else Radburn's men accomplished, they did not learn where the princess was hidden. No matter how much the denizens of the street feared Radburn, they feared the upright man more. Anita heard Hull speaking quietly to Amos. "She's a blockade runner, called the Sea Swift, and she's well named. There's no faster ship left in the harbour, with all the big warships out with Jessop's fleet. You should make good time westward. The prevailing winds are northerly, so you'll have a broad reach most of the way." Amos said, "Trevor, I've sailed the Bitter Sea a bit. I know how the winds blow this time of year as well as any man."
Hull snorted.
"Well then, as you say, your men and the prince's gold are all safely aboard, and Radburn's watchdogs don't seem to have a notion. They still watch the wind of dawn like a mouse or a rat hole, but the Sea Swift is left alone. We've arranged for false papers to be posted with a broker, announcing she's for sale, so even if there was no blockade, they'd not imagine she'd be leaving harbour for some time."
They reached the docks and hurried along to a waiting longboat. There were muffled noises, and Arutha knew the Mockers and Trevor's smugglers were disposing of Radburn's watchmen. Then to the rear, shouts erupted. The clamour of steel broke the still of the morning, and Arutha heard Hull shout, "To the boat!" The pounding of boots upon the wood of the docks set up a racket as Mockers came swarming out of nearby streets, intercepting whoever sought to cut off the escape. They reached the end of the dock and hurried down the ladder to the longboat. Arutha waited at the top of the ladder until Anita was safely down, then turned. As he stepped upon the top rung, he heard the sound of hoofbeats approaching and saw horses crashing through the press of Mockers, who fell before the onslaught. Riders in the black and gold of Bas Tyra hacked down with swords to break free of those seeking to slow them. Martin shouted from the boat, and Arutha hurried down the ladder. As he reached the boat, a voice from above shouted, "Farewell!" Anita looked up and saw Jimmy the Hand hanging over the edge of the dock, a nervous grin on his face. How the boy had managed to join them when everyone thought him safely back at the hiding place, Arutha couldn't guess. Seeing the unarmed boy gave the prince a momentary start. He unbuckled his rapier and tossed it high. "Here, use it in good health." As quick as a striking serpent, Jimmy caught the scabbard, then vanished. Sailors pulled hard against the oars, and the boats sped away from the docks. Lanterns appeared upon the wharves as the sound of battle became louder. Even in the pre-dawn hour, many cries of "What passes?" and "Who goes there?" came from those set to guard ships and cargo in the harbour. Anita watched over his shoulder, trying to see what was occurring behind. More lanterns were being brought, and a fire erupted on the docks. Large bales of something, stored under canvas, exploded into flames. Those in the boat could now clearly see the fight. Many of the thieves were escaping down city streets, or leaping into the icy water of the harbour. Arutha couldn't see the grey-haired figure of Trevor Hull anywhere. or the small one of Jimmy the Hand. Then clearly he saw Jocko Radburn, dressed in a simple tunic, as before. Radburn came to the edge of the dock and watched the retreating boat. He pointed at the fleeing longboat with his sword and shouted something lost in the clamor. Arutha turned and saw Anita sitting opposite him, her hood thrown back, her face clearly visible in the blaze of light from the wharf. Her gaze was caught by the spectacle on shore, and she seemed unaware of her discovery. Arutha quickly pulled her cloak hood about her face, snapping her from her glamour, but he knew the damage was done. He looked back again and saw Radburn ordering his men after the fleeing mockers, retreating down the docks. He stood there alone, then turned away, vanishing in the gloom by the time the longboat reached the Sea Swift. As soon as they were all aboard, Amos's crew cast mooring lines and scrambled aloft to set sails. The Sea Swift began to move from the harbor. The promised gap in the harbor blockade appeared, and Amos set course for it. He was through before any attempt to cut them off could materialize, and suddenly they were outside the harbor, in the open sea. Arutha felt a strange elation as it struck him they were free of Krondor. Then he heard Amos swear, "Look!" In the faint light of the false dawn, Arutha saw the dim shape where Amos pointed. The Royal Griffin, the three-masted warship they had seen when coming into the harbor, was at anchor beyond the breakwater, hidden from the view of any in the city. Amos said, "I thought her out with Jessop's fleet. Damn that Radburn for a crafty swine. She'll be on our wake as soon as he can get aboard." He shouted for all sails to be set and then watched the retreating ship behind. "I'd say a prayer to Ruth, your Highness. If we can steal enough time before she gets underway, we still may be free. But we'll need all the good fortune the Lady of Luck can spare." The morning was clear and cold. Amos and Vasco watched the crew work with approval. The less experienced men had been replaced by men hand-picked by Trevor Hull. They did their work quickly and well, and the Sea Swift raced westward. Anita had been shown to a cabin below, and Arutha and Martin stood on deck with Amos. The lookout reported the horizon clear. Amos said, "It's a close thing, Highness. If they've gotten that brute of a ship underway as quickly as possible, we've only stolen an hour or two on them. Their captain may choose the wrong course. But seeing as we're trying to stay free of Jessop's sea ambush, they're a good bet to follow close to the Keshian coast and risk running into a Keshian warship rather than losing us. I'll not feel comfortable until we're 2 days free of pursuit. But even if they started at once, they'll only make up a small distance each hour. So until we know for certain they have us in sight, we'd all do with a bit of rest. Go below, and I'll call you should anything occur."
Arutha nodded and left. Martin followed. He bid Martin a good rest and watched as the huntmaster entered the cabin he shared with Vasco. Arutha entered his own cabin and stopped when he saw Anita sitting on his bunk. Slowly he closed the door and said, "I thought you were asleep in your own cabin." She shook her head slightly. Then suddenly she was across the short space separating them, her head buried against his chest. Sobs shook her as she said, "I've tried to be brave, Arutha, but I've been so frightened." He stood there awkwardly for a moment, then gently placed his arms around her. The self-reliant pose had crumbled, and Arutha now realized how young she was. Her court training and manners had served her well in maintaining poise among the rough company of the mockers over the month, but her mask could no longer withstand the pressure. He stroked her hair and said, "You'll be fine." He made other reassuring sounds,
not aware of what he was saying, finding her closeness disturbing. She was young enough to make him judge her still a girl, but old enough to make him doubt that judgment. He had never been able to banter lightly with the young women of the court like Roland, preferring a straightforward conversation, which seemed to leave the ladies cold. And he had never commanded their attention the way Liam had, with his blonde good looks and his laughing, easy manner. On the whole, women made him uncomfortable, and this woman, or girl, he couldn't decide which, more than usual. When the tear subsided, he ushered her to the single chair in the cramped cabin and sat upon the bunk. She sniffed once, then said, "I'm sorry, this is so unseemly." Suddenly Arutha laughed. "What a girl you are," he said with genuine affection. "Were I in your place, smuggling myself from the palace, hiding amid cutthroats and thieves, dodging Radburn's weasels and all, I'd have fallen apart long since." She drew a small handkerchief from her sleeve and delicately wiped her nose. Then she smiled at him. "Thank you for saying that, but I think you'd have done better. Martin has told me a lot about you over the last few weeks, and you are a rather brave man by his accounts." Arutha felt embarrassed by the attention. "The Huntmaster has a tendency to overboast," he said, knowing it to be untrue, and changed the subject. "Amos tells me if we don't sight that ship for 2 days, we'll have one free." She lowered her eyes. "That's good." He leaned forward and brushed a tear from her cheek, then, feeling self-conscious, pulled his hand away. "You will be safe with us in Crydee, free from Guy's plottings. My sister will make you a welcome guest in our house." She smiled faintly. "Still, I am worried about father and mother." Arutha tried his best to lay her fears to rest. "With you safely gone from Krondor, Guy cannot gain by causing your parents harm. He may still force a consent to marry from your father, but Erland could do no harm by giving it now. With you out of reach, it's a hollow betrothal. Before this is all done, we shall have an accounting with dear cousin Guy." She sighed, and her smile broadened. "Thank you, Arutha. You've made me feel better." He rose and said, "Try to sleep. I'll use your cabin for the time being." She smiled as she went to his bunk. He closed the door behind him. All at once he felt little need for rest and returned to the deck. Amos stood by the helmsman, eyes fixed astern. Arutha came to stand at his side. Amos said, "There, on the horizon. Can you see it?" Arutha squinted and made out a faint white speck against the blue of the sky. "Radburn?" Amos spat over the transom.
"My guess. Whatever start we've had is being slowly eaten away. But a stern chase is a long chase, as the saying goes. If we can keep far enough ahead for the rest of the day, we might slip them at night. If there's enough cloud cover so the moons don't mark our passage." Arutha said nothing, watching the faint speck in the distance.
Throughout the day, they had watched the pursuing ship grow slowly in size. At first, the tiny speck grew with maddening slowness, but now with alarming speed. Arutha could see the sails clearly defined, no longer a simple blur of white, and he could see a hint of a black speck at the masthead, undoubtedly Guy's banner. Amos regarded the setting sun directly ahead of the fleeing sea swift, then watched the following ship. He shouted to the watch aloft,
"Can you mark her?"
The lookout cried down, "Three-masted warship, Captain." Amos looked at Arutha.
"It's the Royal Griffin. She'll overtake us at sundown. If we had but 10 more minutes or some weather to hide in, or she was just a trifle slower.
What can you do?
Little. In a broad reach, she's faster. Fast enough that we can't shake her with any sort of fancy sailing. If I tried to turn to a beam reach just as she came near, I could put a bit of space between us, for we'd both lose speed, but she'd fall off faster for a time. Then, as soon as they trimmed sails, they'd overhaul us. But that'd send us southward, and there's some fairly nasty shoals and reefs along this stretch of coast, not far from here. It'd be chancy. No, she'll come in somewhat to the windward. When she's alongside, her taller masts will cut our wind, and we'll slow enough for them to board without so much as a by your leave.
Arutha watched the closing ship for another half hour. Martin came on deck and watched as the distance between the two ships shrank by a few feet each minute. Amos held the ship tight to the wind, driving her to the limit of her speed, but still the other closed.
Damn! Said Amos, nearly spitting from frustration. If we were running east, we'd lose them in the dark. But westward, we'll be outlined against the evening sky for some time after the sun sets. They'll still be able to see us when we'll be blind to them.
The sun sank, and the chase continued. As the sun neared the horizon, an angry red ball above the black-green sea, the warship followed by less than 1,000 yards. Amos said,
They might try to foul the rigging or sweep the decks clear with those oversized crossbows, but with a girl aboard, Radburn might not risk it for fear of injuring her.
900, 800 yards, the Royal Griffin came on, rolling inexorably toward them. Arutha could see figures, small silhouettes in the rigging, black against sails turned blood red by the setting sun. When the pursuing ship was 500 yards behind, the lookout shouted,
Fog!
Amos looked up.
Where away?
South by west, 1 mile or more.
Amos sped for the bow, and Arutha followed. In the distance they could see the sun setting, while off to the left a hazy white band stretched across the top of the Black Sea.
Gods! Shouted Amos. We have a chance!
Amos shouted for the helmsman to come to a southwest heading, then sprinted for the stern, Arutha behind him by a step. When they reached the stern, they saw the turn had halved the distance between the ships. Amos said,
Martin, can you mark their helmsman?
Martin squinted, then said,
It's a bit gloomy, but he's not a difficult mark.
Amos said,
See if you can take his mind off holding course.
Martin uncovered his ever-present bow and strung it. He drew out a cloth-yard shaft and sighted on the pursuing ship. He waited, shifting weight to compensate for the rolling of the ship, then let fly. Like an angry bird, the arrow arched over the water, clearing the stern of the following ship. Martin watched the shaft's flight, then quietly hummed an ah to himself. In a single fluid motion, he drew out another arrow, fitted it to the bowstring, pulled, and released. It followed the path of the first, but instead of clearing the rear of the other ship, struck in the transom, quivering mere inches from the helmsman's head. From the sea swift, they could see the Royal Griffin's helmsman dive for the deck, releasing the tiller. The warship swung over and began to fall away. Martin said,
A little gusty for fine shooting.
And sent another arrow to strike within inches of the first, keeping the tiller unmanned. Slowly, the distance between the ships began to widen, and Amos turned to his crew.
Pass the word! When I give the order for silence, any man who drops so much as a whisper is fish bait.
The warship wobbled behind a minute, then swung back on course. Martin said,
Looks like they'll keep a little less broad to us, Amos. I can't shoot through sails. No, but if you'd oblige me by keeping those lads in the bow away from their ballista, I'd be thankful. I think you irritated Radburn.
Martin and Arutha saw the ballista crew readying their weapons. The huntmaster sent a flurry of arrows at the pursuing ship's bow, one arrow following the last before it was halfway to the target. The first struck a man in the leg, felling him, and the other men dove for cover.
Fog dead ahead, Captain,
came the shout from above. Amos turned to the helmsman.
Hard to port?
The Sea Swift angled to the south. The Royal Griffin came hard after, now less than 400 yards behind. As they changed course, the wind died. Approaching the fog bank, Amos said to Arutha,
The winds fall off to less than a bilious fart in there. I'm reefing sails, so the sound of flapping canvas doesn't give us away.
Abruptly, they entered a wall of grey, murky fog, quickly becoming black as the sun sank over the horizon. As soon as the warship vanished from sight, Amos said,
Reef sails!
The crew hauled in sails, quickly slowing the ship. Then Amos said,
Hard to starboard, and pass the word for silence.
Suddenly the ship became graveyard quiet. Amos turned to Arutha and whispered,
This current's here running to the west. We'll let them carry us away from here and hope Radburn's captain is a kingdom seaman. Tiller to midships,
he whispered to the helmsman. To Vasco he said,
Pass the word to lash down the yards, and those aloft are to remain motionless.
Suddenly Arutha became aware of the quiet. After the clamour of the chase, with the fresh north wind blowing, the ropes and sheets singing in the yards, the canvas snapping constantly, this muffled fog bank was unnaturally silent. An occasional groan of a yard moving, or the snap of a rope, were the only sounds in the murk. Fear dragged the minutes out in the seemingly endless vigil. Then, like an alarm ringing out, they heard voices and the sounds of a ship. Creaking yards and the snap of canvas as it moved in the faint wind echoed from all quarters. Arutha couldn't see anything for minutes, until a faint glow pierced through the murk to the rear, passing from northeast to southwest. Lanterns from the pursuing Royal Griffin. Every man aboard the Sea Swift, on deck and above, stayed at his station, afraid to move for the noise that would carry over the water like a clarion. In the distance they could hear a shout from the other ship.
Quiet, damn it! We can't hear them for our own noise!
Then it was suddenly still, save for the rippling of canvas and ropes from the Royal Griffin. Time passed without measure as they waited in the blackness. Then came a hideous grinding sound, ringing like a thunder peal, a tearing, cracking shriek of wood being crushed. Instantly the cries of men could be heard, shouts of panic. Amos turned to the others, half seen in the darkness.
They've shoaled out! From the sound, they've torn the hull right out from under. They're dead men!
He ordered the helm put over to the northwest, away from the shoals and reefs, as sailors hurriedly set sail.
A bad way to die, said Arutha.
Martin shrugged, half lit by the lanterns being brought up on deck.
Is there a good way? I've seen worse.
Arutha left the quarterdeck, the faint, pitiful cries of the drowning men still carrying across the water, a grisly counterpoint to Vasco's more mundane shout to open the galley. He closed the door to the companionway and shut out those unhappy sounds. He quietly opened the door to his cabin and saw Anita lying asleep in the faint light of a shuttered candle. Her red-brown hair looked nearly black as it lay spread about her head. He started to close the door when he heard her say,
Arutha.
He stepped in, finding her watching him in the dim light. He sat on the edge of the berth.
Are you well?
He asked. She stretched and nodded.
I've been sleeping soundly.
Her eyes widened.
Is everything all right?
She sat up, bringing her face close to his.
He reached out and put his arms around her, holding her close. Everything is fine. We're safe now. She sighed as she rested her head on his shoulder. Thank you for everything, Arutha. He said nothing, suddenly caught up in strong emotion. A protective feeling, a need to keep Anita from harm's way, to care for her. For long moments they sat this way. Then Arutha regained control over his surging feelings. Pulling away a little, he said, You'd be hungry, I'd think. She laughed, an honestly merry sound. Why, yes, as a matter of fact, I'm famished. He said, I'll have something sent down, though it will be plain fare, I'm afraid, even compared to what you were given by the mockers. Anything. He went on deck and ordered a seaman to the galley to fetch something for the princess, then returned to find her combing her hair. I must look a mess, she said. Arutha suddenly found himself fighting the urge to grin. He didn't know why, but he was inexplicably happy. Not at all, he said. You look quite nice, actually. She stopped her combing, and Arutha marveled at how she looked so young one minute, so womanly the next. She smiled at him. I remember sneaking a peek at you during Father's court dinner, when you were last in Krondor. At me? What in heaven's name for? She seemed to ignore the question. I thought you looked nice then as well, though a bit stern. There was a boy there who held me up to see. He was with your father's party. I've forgotten his name, but he said he was apprenticed to a magician. Arutha's smile faded. That was Pug. Whatever happened to him? He was lost in the first year of the war. She put aside her comb. I'm sorry. He was kind to a bothersome child. He was a kind lad, given to doing brave things, and he was very special to my sister. She grieved for a long time when he was lost. Fighting back a gloomy mood, he said, Now, why did a princess of Krondor want to sneak a look at a distant and rural cousin? Anita watched Arutha for a long moment, then said, I wanted to see you because our fathers thought it likely we would marry. Arutha was stunned. It took all his control to retain his composure. He pulled over the single chair and sat. Anita said, Didn't your father ever mention it to you? For want of anything clever to say, Arutha merely shook his head. Anita nodded. I know, the war and all. Things did get quite frantic soon after you left for Rillanon. Arutha swallowed hard, finding his mouth suddenly dry. Now, what is this about our father's plans for our marriage? Arutha looked at Anita, her green eyes flickering with reflected candlelight, and something else. Matters of state, I'm afraid. Father wanted my claim to the throne bolstered, and Liam's too dangerous a match, being the older. You'd be ideal, for the king would not likely object. Or wouldn't have then, I guess. Now, with Guy set upon having me, I suppose the king is in agreement. Arutha became suddenly irritated, though he wasn't certain why. And I suppose we're not to be consulted in the matter. His voice rose. Please, it's not my doing. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend you. It's only I'd never given much thought to marriage, and certainly not for reasons of state. The wry grin reappeared. That is usually the province of eldest sons. We second-born, as a rule, are left to get by as best we can. An old widowed countess, or a rich merchant's daughter. He tried to make light of it. A rich merchant's beautiful daughter, if we're lucky, which we usually are not. He couldn't manage a light tone, and sat back. Finally, he said, Anita, you will stay at Crydee as long as need be. It may prove dangerous because of the Surani for a time,
but we'll see that through, somehow. Send you down to Kars, perhaps. When this war is over, you'll go home in safety, I promise you. And never, never shall anyone force you to do anything against your will.
The conversation was interrupted by a knock on the door, and a seaman entered with a steaming bowl of chowder, hard bread, and salted pork on a platter. As the seaman placed the food on the table and poured a cup of wine, Arutha watched Anita. When the sailor was gone, Anita began to eat. Arutha spoke of little things with Anita, finding himself once more captivated by the girl's open, appealing manner. When he finally bade her good night and closed the door, he was abruptly aware the idea of a state marriage was causing him only a little discomfort. He went up on deck. The fog had lifted, and once more they were running before a light breeze. He watched the stars above and, for the first time in years, whistled a happy air. Near the helm, Martin and Amos shared a wineskin and spoke low.
"The prince seems unusually cheerful tonight," said Amos.
Martin blew a puff of smoke from a pipe, which was quickly carried away on the wind.
"And it's a good bet he's not even aware why he feels so cheerful. Anita's young, but not so young he'll be able to ignore her attentions for very long. If she's made up her mind, and I think she has, she'll have him snared within the year, and he'll be glad to be caught."
Amos laughed.
"Though it will be some time before he owns up to it. I'm willing to wager young Roland is hauled up before the altar sooner than Anita."
Martin shook his head.
"That's no wager. Roland's been caught for years. Anita has some work to do yet." "You've never been in love then, Martin?"
Martin said,
"No, Amos. Foresters, like sailors, make poor husbands. Never at home long and spending days, even weeks, alone. Tends to make them a brooding, solitary lot. You?" "Not so you'd notice," Amos sighed. "The older I get, the more I wonder what I've missed."
"But would you change anything?" With a chuckle, Amos said,
"Probably not, Martin. Probably not."
As the ship put in at the quayside, Fannin and Gardan dismounted. Arutha led Anita down the gangway and introduced her to the swordmaster of Crydee.
"We've no carriages in Crydee, Highness," Fannin said to her, "but I'll have a cart sent for at once. It's a long walk to the castle."
Anita smiled. "I can ride, Master Fannin. Any horse that's not too spirited will do." Fannin ordered two of his men to ride to the stable and bring one of Carline's palfreys with a proper side saddle. Arutha asked,
"What news?"
Fannin led the prince off a short distance and said,
"A late thaw in the mountains, Highness, so there has been no major Surani movement as yet. A few of the smaller garrisons have been raided, but there is nothing to indicate a spring offensive here. Perhaps they'll move against your father."
"I hope you're right, for father's received most of the Krondorian garrison." He quickly outlined what had occurred in Krondor, and Fannin listened closely.
"You did well not sailing for your father's camp. I think you judge things correctly. Nothing could prove more disastrous than a major Surani offensive against Duke Borak's position as he was marshalling to march against Guy. Let us keep this to ourselves for a time. Your father will learn what has occurred soon enough, but the more time it takes for him to discover Guy's treachery, the more chance we have of keeping the Surani at bay another year."
Arutha looked troubled. "This cannot continue much longer, Fannin. We must soon see an end to this war." He turned for a moment and saw townspeople begin to gawk at the princess.
"Still, we at least have a little time to come up with something to counter the Surani, if we can but think of it."
Fannin thought a moment, started to speak, then stopped. His expression became grim, almost painful. Arutha said, "What is it, Swordmaster?"
"I have grave and sorry news to greet you with, Highness. Squire Roland is dead."
Arutha was rocked by the news. For a brief moment he wondered if Fannin made some tasteless joke, for his mind would not accept what he had heard. Finally he said,
"What? How?" "News came 3 days ago from Baron Talbot, who is most sorely grieved. The squire was killed in a Surani raid."
Arutha looked at the castle upon the hill.
"Carleen?" "As you would expect. She weeps, but she also bears up well."
Arutha fought back a choking sensation. His face was a grim mask as he moved back to Anita, Amos, and Martin. Word had spread that the Princess of Krondor was upon the wharf. The soldiers who had ridden with Fannin and Gardan formed a quiet ring around her, keeping the townsfolk at a respectful distance, while Arutha shared the sad news with Amos and Martin. Soon the horses arrived, and they were in the saddle, riding toward the castle. Arutha spurred his horse on and was dismounted before the others had entered the courtyard. Most of the household staff awaited him, and with little ceremony he shouted to House Carl Samuel,
"The Princess of Krondor is guesting with us. See, rooms are made ready. Escort her to the Great Hall and tell her I will join her shortly."
He hurried through the entrance of the keep, past guards who snapped to attention as their prince strode by. He reached Carleen's suite and knocked upon the door.
"Who is it?"
came the soft voice from within.
"Arutha."
The door flew open, and Carleen rushed into her brother's arms, holding him tightly.
"Oh, I'm so glad you are back. You don't know how glad."
She stepped back and looked at him.
"I'm sorry. I was going to ride down to meet you, but I just couldn't seem to gather myself together."
"Fannin just told me. I'm so very sorry."
She regarded him calmly, her face set in an expression of acceptance. She took him by the hand and led him to her chambers. Sitting upon a divan, she said,
"I always knew it might happen. It was the silliest thing, you know. Baron Talbot wrote a very long letter, the poor man. He saw so little of his son and was stricken."
Tears began to come, and she swallowed hard, looking away from Arutha.
"Roland died."
"You don't have to tell me."
She shook her head.
"It's all right. It hurts."
Again tears came, but she spoke through them.
"Oh, it hurts. But I'll get over the pain. Roland taught me that, Arutha. He knew there were going to be risks, and should he die, I'd have to keep living my own life. He taught me well. I think because I finally learned how much I loved him and told him so, I gained the strength to cope with this loss. Roland died trying to save some farmer's cows."
Through the tears, she smiled.
"Isn't that like him? He spent the entire winter building up the fort, and then the first time there's trouble, it's some hungry Surani trying to steal some skinny cows. Roland went riding out with his men to chase them away, but got shot by an arrow. He was the only one hurt, and he died before they could get him back to the fort."
She sighed long.
"He was such a jester at times. I almost think he did it on purpose."
She began to weep, and Arutha watched in silence. Quickly she regained control over herself and said,
"No good comes from this, you know."
She rose and looked out a window and said, quietly,
"Damn this stupid war."
Arutha came over to her, holding her tightly for a moment.
"Damn all wars," he said.
For a few more minutes they were quiet. Then she said,
"Now tell me, what news from Krondor?"
Arutha gave her a brief account of his experiences in Krondor, half his attention on her. She seemed much more accepting of Roland's loss than she had when grieving for Pug. Arutha shared her pain, but also felt certain she would be all right. He was pleased to discover just how much Carlene had matured over the last few years. When he finished telling of Anita's rescue, Carlene interrupted.
Anita, the Princess of Krondor, is here?
Arutha nodded, and Carlene said,
I must look a fright, and you bring the Princess of Krondor here? Arutha, you are a monster!
She rushed to a polished metal mirror and fussed with her face, daubing at it with a damp cloth. Arutha smiled. Under the mantle of mourning, his sister still showed a spark of her natural spirit. Combing her hair out, Carlene turned to face her brother.
Is she pretty, Arutha?
Arutha's wry smile was replaced by a grin.
Yes, I'd say she is pretty.
Carlene studied Arutha's face.
I can see I'll have to get to know her well.
She put down her comb and straightened her gown. Extending her hand to him, she said,
Come, we can't keep your young lady waiting.
Hand in hand, they left the room and walked down the stairs to the main hallway to welcome Anita to Crydee.
Chapter 8. Great One. An abandoned house overlooked the city. The site upon which the house had been constructed had once seen the lights of a great family manse. On top of the highest of many rolling hills surrounding the city of Ontoset, it was considered the choicest view of the city and the sea beyond. The family had come to low estate, the result of being on the losing side in one of the empire's many subtle but lethal political struggles. The house had fallen into disrepair, and the property been ignored, for while it was as fine a building site as any found in the area, the association of ill fortune with the property was too real for the superstitious Surani. One day news reached the city that some Kula herders had awakened to the sight of a single black-robed figure walking up the hill toward the old house. They all acted with haste to avoid him, in the socially correct fashion for their station. They stayed within the area, tending their animals, the source of their meager income. Cooler wool, when, near midday, they heard a great noise, as if the heavens above them had erupted with the grandfather of all thunder peals. The herd scattered in terror, some running up the hill. The herders were no less terrified, but true to their trade, they put aside their fears and chased after the animals. One herder, a man named Xanathus, came to the top of the once famous hill to be greeted by the sight of the black-robed magician he had seen earlier, standing upon the crest. Where the run-down great house had stood moments before, a large patch of smoking land was laid bare, several feet below the level of the grass that surrounded it. Fearing he had intruded upon some business of a great one, Xanathus started to back away, hoping to avoid detection. For the Great One's back was to the herder, and his cowl was drawn over his head. As he took the first step backward, the magician turned to face him, fixing him with a pair of unsettlingly deep brown eyes. The herder lowered himself as custom demanded, on his knees, eyes cast downward. He did not fully abase himself, for he was a freeman, and while not a noble, he was head of his family.
Stand up, the magician ordered.
Slightly confused, Xanathus rose, eyes still cast downward.
Look at me.
He looked up and found the face in the cowl regarding him closely. A beard as dark as the eyes framed a fair face, a fact that added to Xanathus's discomfort, as only slaves wore beards. The magician smiled at this obvious confusion and walked around the herder, inspecting him. The magician saw a man tall for a Surani, an inch or two taller than his own 5 feet 8. His skin was dark, like unclouded chocha or coffee. His eyes were black, and his hair was black as well, save where it was shot with white. The herder's short green robe revealed the powerful build of a former soldier, a fact the magician gleaned from the man's erect posture and several scars. Past 50 he looked, but still capable of the strenuous life of a herder. Though shorter, this man resembled Gardan of Crydee slightly.
"Your name?"
asked the magician, as he came round to stand before the herder. Xanathus answered, his voice betraying his unease. The magician then startled him by asking,
"Would you agree that this is a good place for a home, herdsman?"
Confused, Xanathus stammered,
If it is your will, great one."
The magician snapped,
"Ask not what I think. I ask your thoughts."
Xanathus could barely hide his anger at his own shame. Great ones were sacrosanct, and to be false with one was to do a dishonor.
"Forgive me, great one. It is said this spot is ill-favored by the gods."
"And who is it that says so?"
The sharpness in the magician's voice caused the older man's head to snap up as if he had been struck. His eyes hid little of his anger, but his voice remained calm as he said,
"Those who live in the city, great one, and others about the countryside."
The herdsman met the magician's gaze and held it. The corners of the magician's eyes wrinkled in mirth, and his mouth turned up a little, but his voice still rang out.
"But not you, herder?"
"I was 15 years a soldier, great one. I have found it often the case that the gods favor those who take care of their own welfare."
The magician smiled at this, though it was not an entirely warm expression.
"A man of self-reliance. Good. I am glad we are of a like mind, for I plan to build my estate here, as I have a taste for the view of the sea."
A certain stiffness of posture in the herder's stance at this remark caught the magician's notice, and he said,
"Have I your approval, Xanathus of Ontoset?"
Xanathus shifted his weight from one foot to the other, then said,
"The Great One jests with me. My approval or disapproval is of no consequence, I am certain."
"True, but you still avoid my question. Have I your approval?"
Xanathus's shoulders sagged a little as he said,
"I will have to move my herds, great one. That is all. I mean no disrespect."
"Tell me of this house, Xanathus, that stood here before this day."
"It was the home of the Lord of the Almac, great one. He backed the wrong cousin against Almicha when the office of warlord was contested."
He shrugged.
"I was once a patrol leader of that house. I was a prideful man, which limited my advancement as a soldier. My lord gave me permission to leave his service and marry, so I took over my wife's father's herds. Had I stayed a soldier, I would now be a slave, dead, or a grey warrior."
He glanced out toward the sea.
"What more would you know, great one?"
The magician said,
"You may keep your herds upon this hill, Xanathus. The grazers keep the grass neat, and I have no liking for unkempt grounds. Just keep them away from the main house where I will be working, else I cook one for my supper now and again."
Without another word, the magician pulled a device from within his robe and activated it. A strange hum was emitted for a moment. Then the black-robed figure disappeared with a small popping sound. Xanathus stood quietly for a few minutes, then resumed his search of his lost animals. Later that night, around a campfire, he told his family and the other herders of his meeting with the Great One. None doubted his word, for whatever his other faults might be, Xanathus was not one to expand upon the truth, but they were amazed. And they never quite got used to one other thing. Over the following months, while a new great house was being built, one or another of the herdsmen would occasionally catch sight of Xanathus engaged in conversation with a great one, atop the hill while Cooler grazed below them. Now a new and strange house stood atop the hill. It was the source of both some speculation and a little envy. The speculation was about its owner, the strange Great One. The envy was over its design and construction, something of a revolution in Surani architecture. Gone was the traditional three-story open-center building. In its place was a long single-story building, with several smaller ones attached to it by covered walkways. It was a rambling affair, with many small gardens and waterways winding between the structures. Its construction was as much a sensation as its design, for it consisted mainly of stone, with fired brick tiles upon the roof. Some speculated that it offered cool protection during the heat of summer. Two other facts added to the fascination evidenced over the house and its owner. First was the manner in which the project had been commissioned. The magician had first appeared in Ontoset one day, at the home of Tumasel, the richest moneylender in the city. He appropriated over 30,000 imperials in funds and left the moneylender stricken over his loss of liquidity. This was Malamba's method of dealing with the Surani passion for bureaucracy. Any merchant or tradesman commanded to render service to a great one was forced to petition the imperial treasury for repayment. This resulted in slow delivery of ordered materials, less than enthusiastic service, and resentment. Malamba simply paid in advance and left it to the moneylender, who was better able to account for his losses than most other merchants by nature of his bookkeeping, to recover from the treasury. The second fact was the style of decoration. Instead of the garishly bold wall paintings, the building was left mostly unpainted, except for an occasional landscape in muted natural colors. Many fine young artists were employed on this project, and when it was done, the demand for their services was phenomenal. Within a month, a new wave in Surani art was in progress. 50 slaves now worked the outlying fields, all free to come and go as they wished, dressed in the garb of their homeworld, Midkemia. All had been taken from the slave market one day, without payment, by the Great One. Many travellers to Ontoset would make an afternoon of climbing the hills nearby to see the house. From a respectable distance, of course. The herder, Xanathus, was questioned many times about the strange Great One who lived in that house. But the former soldier said nothing, only smiling a great deal. The belief that the current great rift to Midkemia is controllable is only partially correct. Malamba paused, allowing his scribe to finish copying the dictation. It can be stated that rifts may be established without the release of destructive energies associated with their accidental creation, either through poorly effected magic spells or by the proximity of too many unstable magic devices. Malamba's research into the special aspects of rift energies would be added to the Assembly's archives when completed. Like other projects he had read of in the archives, research into rifts had shown what Malamba took to be a grievous flaw in most of his brother magician's work. In general, projects were not carried through to completion, showing a lack of thoroughness. Once the procedure to establish rifts safely had been developed, further research into their nature had been halted. Continuing, he dictated, "What is lacking in the concept of control is the ability to select the terminus of contact, the ability to target the rift. It has been shown by the appearance of the ship carrying Fanatha on the shores of Cryde, on the world of Midkemia,
but a certain affinity between a newly forming rift and an existing one is probable. However, as shown by further testing, this affinity is limited, such limits being as yet not fully understood. While there is increased probability of a second rift appearing within a regional proximity to the first, it is by no means a certainty. When the scribe was caught up, Malamba added, "Also, there is a question of why rifts show certain inconsistencies. Size appears relative to the energy employed in their formation, but other characteristics seem without pattern. Some rifts are single direction." Malamba had lost several valuable devices discovering this fact, "while others allow movement in two directions. And then there are bonded pairs, two single-direction rifts that appear simultaneously, both allowing one-way travel between origin and terminus. Though they may appear miles apart, they are related." Malamba's narration was interrupted by the sound of the chimes announcing the arrival of someone from the assembly. He dismissed his scribe and made his way to the pattern room. As he walked, he mused on the